the Mediterranean diet plus nuts.
When is stress testing not recommended?
Are autism and allergies linked?
And trends in suicide rates in the United States.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on June 15th, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, if you're okay with this, I'd like to turn directly to the New England Journal of Medicine. One of the studies that I picked for this week, the primary prevention of cardiovascular disease with a Mediterranean diet supplemented with extra virgin olive oil or nuts. Woo, there's a big one. And one of the things I thought was so fascinating was that this actually was a republication of this study. So they had originally sent it in and they didn't go through all of the nuts relative to the Mediterranean diet. And that just seems like a really big omission to me. So I think there's probably a backstory that I at least would be really interested in. In any case, this was a study that was undertaken in Spain, where just under 7,500 participants were recruited, many of whom were women, and of course, we're really happy with that, who were already at high cardiovascular disease risk, but without apparent cardiovascular disease at enrollment. And they were randomized to three diet choices: Mediterranean diet supplemented with extra virgin olive oil, the same supplemented with mixed nuts, or a control diet, which was just advice to reduce their dietary fat. They also had educational sessions and sometimes some free extra virgin olive oil or mixed nuts, and I would be happy with that one too. And their primary outcome was a major cardiovascular event. Median follow-up just under 5 years, and then the trial was stopped. What they found was that a primary endpoint occurred in 288 participants. There were 96 events in the group assigned to a Mediterranean diet with olive oil, 83 in the group with the nuts in the Mediterranean diet, and 109 in the control group. So the outcome of this whole thing suggests that a Mediterranean diet that's supplemented with nuts is probably a really good choice, as well as one with the extra virgin olive oil. And of course, this is something we've been trying to get our arms around for a really long time.
So Elizabeth, as you mentioned, in 2013, they first reported the results from this trial. So why re-report it? Well, here's the story behind the story. It was supposed to be a randomized controlled trial. But when somebody looked at it subsequently, they realized the groups were not balanced. And the investigators did some digging and realized that the groups really weren't randomized at all. At several of the sites, they enrolled family members to the exact same diet as somebody originally enrolled. In other ones, they didn't randomize at all. They had an entire clinic with one of the diets versus a different clinic with a different one. So in this study, they had to completely reanalyze the data, and also doing a secondary analysis where they took out those non-randomized individuals. The long and the short is the New England Journal of Medicine made them do it right. They still found that there was about a 30% reduction in cardiovascular events with the Mediterranean diet, either supplemented with nuts or with extra virgin olive oil.
Yeah, and that's pretty powerful. And of course, it's a diet that supports things that at least we're already doing. So I suppose that's good news, and I guess I'm also glad that NEJM is being really vigilant with regard to the veracity of the studies that they publish.
Absolutely. Hats off to the New England Journal of Medicine that really tries to do science at the highest level.
Okay. Let's turn from here to something that is very sobering. In MMWR, Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report, a publication of the CDC, a look at suicide data.
And this is a look at the U.S. data based upon the National Violent Death Reporting System and the National Vital Statistics System. The latter encompasses all 50 states, the former about 27 states. And the sobering thing was that in the vast majority of states, in all except one, there was an increase in suicide rates. And it was a greater than 30% in 25 different states. It was an increase for both males and females. Over half the suicides were in individuals that did not have a history of mental or behavioral health issues.
Incredibly sobering, and in the wake of the two celebrity suicides in the last week also, if you were the king of the forest, what would you do?
Well, for those that had mental health issues, at least two-thirds of them had been treated for it, and a half of them were already undergoing treatment at the time they committed suicide. That tells me we need to extend treatment. What about those that don't have mental health issues? In digging a little bit deeper, they realized that the issues that brought someone to consider suicide were troubles with relationships, life stressors, and recent impending crises. What the Center for Disease Control has recommended is a more comprehensive approach that looks at not only identifying individuals, but doing things societally. We live in a world where we try to remove stress. Stress is never going to be removed. What we need to do is we need to engage people with the coping mechanisms that allows them to deal with early stressors. Also, for those people that are suffering financial loss, having trouble affording housing or eviction, we need to address that as a society as well. The goal from the CDC is to reduce suicide by 20% by 2025.
Okay, let's turn from here to JAMA Open, a new journal. This is the first time that we're reporting any studies from this. In this case, this is in the pediatric age group, the Association of Food Allergy and Other Allergic Conditions with Autism Spectrum Disorder. I thought this was interesting. Of course, it's a snapshot. It's a population-based cross-sectional study using information from the National Health Interview Survey collected between 1997 and 2016. And the data analysis was just performed. All eligible children aged 3 to 17 years were included, and they looked at food allergy, respiratory allergy, and skin allergy, and the incidence of autism. And basically, the finding of this study, this cross-sectional study, with almost 200,000 children, did find an association between common allergic conditions, in particular allergies to foods, which we know are increasing, and an association with autism spectrum disorders. Of course, there's no information whatsoever on why this may be true.
As you noted, this is an observational study. We know that autism spectrum disorders have been increasing. They've doubled over the last decade. And we also know that there are both genetic influences and environmental influences. And what this group hypothesized was that perhaps early immune activation through allergies could affect neurodevelopment. That neurodevelopment would lead to autism spectrum disorders. Kids with autism spectrum disorder were twice as likely as those without to have one or more of these allergic reactions. It does provide some support to the hypothesis, but certainly does not prove that immune reactions lead to autism.
I think it would be really interesting to gather additional data, historical data on this, and I suspect it would be fairly robust in terms of how much data might be mined, how many kids with autism do have allergic conditions, and what about families that are known to have allergic conditions? Do these kids also suffer more with regard to autism spectrum disorders?
You're right, Elizabeth, but there are a lot of different ways to approach this. One of the things that this study is lacking is any temporal relationship. I mean, what you'd like to know is the allergy came first and then the autism later. So I look forward to future studies that either confirm this or refute this.
Indeed. Well, finally then, let's turn to your wheelhouse in the Journal of the American Medical Association. What about those screening EKGs? Are they really any good?
The short answer to that long question is that either resting or a stress EKG in low-risk, asymptomatic individuals is not helpful. It's not recommended. And that's according to the United States Preventive Services Task Force that did a revision of a statement done in 2004 and 2012 and now looking at additional data. This is important in my particular practice where people come to me and say, I want to have a stress test, and they're low risk. Now, when I say low risk, you can either use the Framingham risk score or what's called the U.S. Pooled Cohort Equations to determine what someone's risk is of cardiovascular disease. And we know that if someone's in a low risk category, the risk of having heart disease is less than 1% per year. And we base our therapy depending upon whether there's low risk or high risk, how intensive it is. Does a routine stress test add any additional information? And the answer is no, it doesn't.
We've talked a lot before about how long it takes for these kinds of things to penetrate common practice. If you were a betting guy, what would you say?
This is a hard one because the general public thinks that unless I'm having a stress test, I'm not undergoing a thorough exam. From the physician standpoint, even though we know that these equations based upon these risk factors predict someone's risk of cardiovascular disease, only about 40% of physicians actually use them in their daily practice. So we have a lot of work to do. What I want our listeners to know is the doctor that says, listen, if you're low risk and asymptomatic, we don't need to do a stress test. You say, well, what harm is there? Well, because in that group of individuals, it's more likely to be a false positive, at least an unnecessary angiogram, and sometimes to unnecessary revascularization. And those both carry risk associated with them.
I like that, of course. Anything that reduces unnecessary testing, in my mind, is a great outcome. On that note, I'm going to talk about the Mediterranean diet because of this very stellar, let's call it, choice of the New England Journal of Medicine to require a recrunching of the numbers. That is the one I will discuss this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.